Like notes to the hourglass, these are the songs of our lives.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Songs of Our Lives. I'm Brad Rose. I am an artist, a composer, a writer, founder of Foxy Digitalis, and somebody who thinks about music and sound far more than is healthy. Each week, I invite on a guest to talk about these songs and the music that has meant a lot and left its mark. Previous guests include Amelia Courthouse, Tomine, Claire Rousset, Jeffrey Silverstein, Maurice. The list goes on and on and on and on. This week, I am excited to have Jason Woodbury. This is a really fun one because this was the second time. I think this is the second time I've had a quote unquote music writer on. Jason's a whole lot more than that. And we talk about that. But the other one was Mark Masters. And there's a pretty amazing and hilarious connection between the two of those episodes, which you'll hear in the episode. But I do need to mention, of course, Jason writes for Aquarium Drunker, does the amazing Transmissions podcast, does so many things, Wastoids, so many things. But he also has some new music out on Fort Lowell Records. So he had an EP that came out a couple months ago, the solo one under JPW. And then just out is Two Against Nurture, which is a 3-song EP with Dadweed. Dadweed, great, great project name. And it is, it's really good. I really enjoyed it. It just has this feeling of, there's this like generous spirit in it. And it's like, you know, and we talk about it in the first part of the show, but it's just, it's really been resonating with me these last few weeks. And it's been hard for me to kind of explain, but I highly recommend checking it out. And I guess it's a precursor to a full length that's on the way next year. And yeah, listen to the Transmissions podcast. Just Jason is up to so many interesting things, always doing cool stuff. So if you're not following him, get on that. But yeah, otherwise, hope you enjoy the episode. My guest today is a writer, a critic, a musician, a songwriter, a podcaster. It's Jason Woodbury. Welcome to the show.
Hey, woo-hoo! so glad to be here. Thanks for having me, Brad.
Yeah. So, what's it like being on the other side?
It's always weird. It truly is. I find myself, because I do a podcast and because I understand the mechanics of interviewing, I often find myself beating myself up after I finish these things that I wasn't like a more entertaining guest, or I didn't deliver enough good anecdotes, I wasn't witty enough, you know, because these are the things I love in a guest, you know.
Sure.
But it's always fun, and it's certainly like a big pleasure and honor to get to hang out with you, chat, and
awesome.
Talk about stuff that means a lot to me. So I do appreciate it for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Every time I've been on the other side, it makes me appreciate being on this side even more.
Like, yeah. 100%. You feel for, it has been good to be interviewed, you know, because it, I like to think feeds back into the interviewing, you know, because it is a, it's a tricky balance. But I certainly love talking too much. So, so I can provide that side of it at least.
Yeah. I know that feeling. We weren't really touching on this before we started, but I'm always curious. So when, like, I'm a person who I write music, make music, but I also write about music and I do, so first for you, like, which came first? Like, were you writing about music and, like, you know, that side of it or were you playing music? Like, what came first? Or did it start kind of at the same time?
It started pretty close to the same time, kinda. You know, when I was in high school, I started playing in bands and writing songs, in earnest. And then just kind of like made my way into writing. You know, I would write for, I kind of like restarted the school newspaper where I went to high school. Just it, like it wasn't active, but I started it just so I could write like record reviews of Foo Fighter albums or whatever, you know? And so like that was, it was always kind of, they feel pretty tied together, but technically, you know, making music came first.
Okay. I'm curious too, like, so this is something I think about a lot, like how sort of, maybe not balancing those things, like how they sort of interact with each and influence each other, like the writing and talking to people, you know, from as an interviewer, as a journalist, I guess, if you want to say that. I always feel weird if people call me a journalist, but versus, you know, and making, I'm just, yeah, like what's the interaction or like cross section of that look like?
I guess it's changed over the years, you know. I basically probably in like, you know, the 2010s had got jobs in music, you know, unrelated to playing, was working at like the Alt Weekly and working with a record store and sort of doing things like ancillary to the actual act of playing music. And for a while, that side of it kind of faded. I didn't play out very much, or I would play in a project that was just kind of me and my buddies kicking around songs every now and then. So it never like completely went away, but for nearly a decade, it was pretty backburnered. And then, you know, during the pandemic, like so many people, I think I just found myself drawn back to creating art and feeling like a pretty intense desire and need to create things. And since then, the balance has been strange for me because I don't know. You know, it has definitely forced me to start thinking about things that I thinking about music in new ways, you know, and sort of the desire to devote so much energy to making things has really started to clarify for me some of the things that I think are important about music, or like what, you know, what, when you're putting time and energy into something, you know, there's constantly a sort of justification thing going on in your head. And so that's revealed to me some new angles on making music, on creativity, on expression, on the subconscious or the unconscious, or, you know, whatever that might be. So that has sort of like led into the interviewing side too. You know, I'm sort of approaching it from that. I'm very loath to like even bring up my own music on the podcast most of the time because I am nervous to do so, uncertain, maybe a little sheepish or guarded or embarrassed. I've tried to let that mask fall, and a few times when it's made sense in my head, at least, to sort of like come at it from that angle and cop to the fact that I also make things. That's happened here and there throughout the podcast too, but more on the side of sort of just when I'm writing questions, when I'm researching, when I'm thinking about records, I just find that, you know, maybe playing music has opened up some different angles, some different side entrances into the conversations, you know? So that's happened more and more as I've gotten more and more comfortable, you know, with,
I relate to that. That resonates with me like very much so. I remember this is 12 years ago, whenever Foxy Digital stopped for the first time, or technically the second time, because it was a zine back in the 90s. But so it was like 2013 and my wife was pregnant and I'm just like, I can't, something's got to give here. And so walked away from Foxy D and I really kind of stopped writing about music. And then and kept making music, kept doing, you know, the label and stuff. And it didn't occur to me until years later, like, because it was different. And part of that, obviously, was like, I became a dad. That fucking changes your whole brain. But like, I realized, oh, like a big, for me, so much of it was that relationship between the two things. And
it felt like each one kind of helped me understand the other one, the other side of it in different ways. And so when I kind of came back to it during the pandemic, like, yeah, I mean, I had the same, I'd kind of been away from really making music for a while. I mean, you know, mess around in my house and stuff, but yeah, it became very intentional again during the pandemic because there was all this time and it's like, who knows if the world's going to be here tomorrow. I knew I wanted, I need to do both things again because that's kind of the way my brain knows how to operate. And so,
yeah. They both influence and they both inform and they both, you know, there are times where I want to do one way more than I want to do the other though, you know, that happens. And that's been its own like recognition too, of being like, you know, if you're not careful, you can almost start to feel, you know, guilty for not like covering enough or not doing enough or not writing enough. I struggle with that.
Same.
And it's a thing that I have really been trying to be like more honest with myself in terms of like recognizing that guilt is not coming from the place that I am going to get anything good out of. You know what I mean? It doesn't.
Absolutely.
But nonetheless, you look out and you see how much incredible art is being released and how much stuff you like legitimately dig and love and want to trumpet, you know? And then, you know, you're faced with a blank Google Docs screen and you're just like, I don't know. I can't do it, you know? And it's the weirdest thing.
Gosh, man.
And then you go through all these negotiations with yourself. You know it, I'm sure, all too well. Man. I think anybody who does this does, but there's been a certain part of me that's had to be like, yeah, that's understandable. And I know where that's coming from. And you do feel a kind of responsibility to cover things you care about. And that's good. But there are also going to be times where the expression that's much more important is the one where you're writing a dumb song, you know, for yourself.
Right.
And you might have to do that. And you're just going to have to accept that. And that's me talking to me.
Right. No, I mean, that's it's, you could be me talking to me as well. I mean, I struggle with that on a daily basis. Probably daily basis, because it's, you know, I mean, as anybody who writes about music or is involved, like, you get so many pitches every day, and I appreciate, and I like, you know, all the love in the world to people just trying to get people to hear the things, and a lot of, I mean, and I think that's the thing, I hear so much stuff that I'm intrigued by, or I really, but I'm one person.
That's true. That's it. Yeah.
And that's what I keep telling myself and trying, you know, because it's like, and I would rather feel guilty about it than start to resent it. Because I feel like resentment feels like way worse, because that's when you get burnt out and you get, I mean, I still struggle with burnout sometimes, but
yeah. I definitely know what you mean. And all that is stuff to be contended with. You know, for sure.
But hey, keep sending me your pitches, you know, and I, you know,
me too.
We're all, and like, I always try to just come from the like approach of like, we're all doing our best here, everybody. Like y'all were, everyone's, it's a struggle, and just give everybody some grace. So,
little grace never hurts.
Exactly. Well, I do want to real quick ask about your new EP with Dadweed, which Dadweed is, oh my god, the greatest project name ever, maybe. Even though I'm a dad and I don't smoke weed, which is, you know, not a judgment call, but just makes me lazy and crazy. But how did that come together? Because it's a fucking blast to listen to.
Thank you, man. Yeah, so that's my musical partner, Zach Toporek, and the story behind the band name is his to tell. So I will not I will not tell it for him, but it is it's a more literal thing than one might expect. But you know, we worked together a little on my first JPW record. He plays. Mm-hmm. Plays drums and recorded some of it, and plays some guitar and keys on the record too. We've known each other for just a really long time. He used to have a project called Young Mothers, and I was in a band called Hands on Fire, and we'd play a bunch of shows together. And had always just like really dug each other's vibes. And yeah, during the pandemic, kind of just reconnected. And I made a record with my friends in Kitimoto, which was a whole other record where I'm just playing guitar and my friend John is the songwriter. We made that record. I went right into making the next record with Zach and my producer on that one, Michael Krasner. And then we went right from that into making just a record that was essentially just Zach and I in the studio, kind of doing 50-50, you know, both singing songs, both writing, you know, me writing lyrics for him to sing, him writing lyrics for me to sing, harmonies, just blasting out songs. And so we really quickly amassed like a whole other record. And and this EP is a little bit of a moose boosh to that proper release that will be coming out. But yeah, Two Against Nurture, which is our Steely Dan joke. Steely Dan has an album called Two Against Nature. And we jokingly, you know, both in like joking about therapy speak and whatever else, you know, I had a lot of fun with this. But so the first song is, that's kind of a spoiler. I'm sort of like revealing the behind the scenes stuff, but the first song is from the record. And then the next two songs are, When I Get Lonesome is a more recent track that we did, that, you know, that just sort of stumbled together in the last couple months. And then Big Wave, the final sort of, song on the EP, not sort of song. Why would I say sort of song? It's a song. The final song on the three song EP, is like an improv that we, did when we were first started. And then we kind of took that improv and like cut it and shaped it and, you know, had ended up writing some words and stuff. And so that's not on, you know, that'll be exclusive to this EP, but, as is the second song, but yeah, so that's sort of the thing, and it's it kind of represents a different sound than my record. But that was, I think, sort of what was fun about it for us, was that it didn't sound like either of our. He makes records under the Dad Weed banner too, and this doesn't really sound like those either. It sounds like it's some other third mind melody situation.
That's always, like whenever I go into collaborations, like that's always my goal, is like, I don't want this to sound like me, or I want it to sound like something different, like, which is, it can be hard to do. Like sometimes it, you know, and I've heard lots of great collaborations where it's like, this sounds like those two people doing the thing they do like really well together. And that's cool too. But I really like that this, has its own feel, and I'm excited that there's a whole record. That's really, and that may have been in like the press release that I didn't read.
So. No. It's not. And I'm sure, I hope that James at Fort Lowell Records isn't like, why did you tell everybody that that's how it's working? But that is just the truth of it. And, you know, it's kind of weird. We've had the record done for a little bit, and I'm really excited to share it. You know, I do think that there are plenty of threads that connect it to my previous record or the other EP, you know, Raw Action En Route, which is my other JPW release that came out a few months ago. And there are like commonalities that cross over, but, you know, when you're writing, you know, in that sort of 50-50 way, just two people in a studio, and we would just spend the weekend just, you know, often kind of writing and arranging and all that stuff on the spot. And it really was a lot of fun. It was so much fun, easily the most effortless thing that I've ever been involved in musically. And really there was very little thought going on. It was all instinct and, just having a blast. And so as a result, I think the record's kind of all over the place and maybe a little anarchic and explore some like poppier textures that are, you know, Corner Shop was a huge influence on that first track, Everybody's Talking and stuff like that. And my mom said it sounded like the Bare Naked Ladies. And at first all of this stuff, like really weirded me out, and I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing. But on the topic of, you know, writing about music and, you know, making it, with this record, I found myself a little bit like, if I had to review this record, what would I say about it? And I wasn't, I found myself very uncertain what I would say about it if this were a record that had been sent to me. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that was a new, a new feeling of like, okay, what does this mean then? Who am I? Where did this come from? Is this me? Is it stylistically correct? Yeah. All these things, you know, new questions for me, but fun and interesting challenges, you know?
I mean, that's exciting. Those are always exciting places to find yourself, I think, where, and I've talked about this on the podcast, where like, I find myself drawn to music that kind of confounds me, where I hear it and it's like I connect to it, but I'm like, I can't figure out why, or it's not immediately clear. Like, yeah. And obviously there's some we all have our things where it's like, you know, oh, it checks these, this is in my wheelhouse, like, of course I like it. But and so that's really interesting to it makes me really excited to hear the record too. And I think just kind of what you're talking about, like the fun, like that sort of spirit of camaraderie and stuff that you guys had in the studio, like I think that comes through in the music. Like, no, there's like a joyfulness to it, which is that's something especially in the year 2024,
right? Yeah. And this was seriously though, and really, you know, I'm glad you said that, and I appreciate you saying that, but it does, at the risk of sounding like cheesy or overly earnest, you know, which nobody has ever accused me of. No, I'm just kidding. That joy is really what, that, like, hearing that joy is really what propelled me to say, to let the inner critic kind of like stand by, you know, like you're not needed right now. Mm-hmm. We're going to make these songs. And it's funny too, because we're talking about, you know, an album of pop rock songs. So it's not like, this music is so confounding because nobody's ever made anything like it. It's just more, you know, my first record, Something Happening, Always Happening. You know, the tonal palette was pretty sort of within like, whatever, the Aquarium Drunkard wheelhouse, if you want to put it that way, right?
Sure.
And this one, maybe a little not so much or less, you know, on the nose. And that's the sort of thing that, the sort of like aesthetic and the editor mind and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I just recognized that as valuable as those things are, and as much as they do come into, you know, play, certainly when you're mixing the record, when you're deciding whether the lyric is too dumb or, you know, things like that. So it's not like that side of me got completely put away, but I had to sort of like, I just basically had to give myself permission to have a blast with my friend making a record and not really worry about it and not really sweat if it doesn't sound the way, because we even had, you know, people say like, yeah, this is a pretty different sound. You know, I don't know if people, and it's like, you know, I don't know. You just like kind of like wrap your arms around that idea and just sort of be like, we had so much fun making this thing and we weren't overthinking it and we were being playful and we were being joyful. Those are not easy modes to get into. So if you've somehow figured out how to slip into that zone, you know, I think that deserves some honoring, you know, if it, 100%. if I can put it that, you know, pretentiously.
No, I feel that completely. Well, I could keep, keep going on about this, but you know, then this podcast will be 2 hours long and nobody wants a 2 hour long podcast.
We're not, you're not Joe Rogan. You're not the best show.
Yeah.
Tom Sharpling, 3 hours. Incredible.
It's amazing. I mean,
I listen to all 3 hours of The Best Show. Not, I don't listen to Rogan, but I listen to his are long.
Yeah. Very. Yeah. And, God. Okay. Well, there's no segue here. So we're just going to go right into it, to the reason we're here.
I love it.
First question, as always, what is the first song you remember?
The first song that I remember is called Tightrope by Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band. And I know that it is one of the first songs I remember because there exists a, I don't know where it is. It might not exist anymore, but at one point, a small cassette of me singing this song at like age two or two and a half or something, like very, very young. And I had gotten a hold of my grandparents' cassette recorder, and we were on a road trip, and I was obsessed with this song. So there's sort of an a cappella version of me singing Tightrope by Bob Seger. And I revisited it to kind of get ready for this podcast and was just shocked that it sounds the way it does. Because it's just so over the top. I mean, it's like ZZ Top synths with this like kind of like like really dramatic, over the top, you know, sort of grandiosity. And the lyrics are just like really like fraught and like, you know, over the top, dramatic. I listened to it and was like, I get. So this was a song I was way into. But it was just really funny hearing it. So yeah, it's, I remember other songs too, you know, early song memories are great. And I almost put down this, I remember being young and very young, and some guy was on public access television or maybe it was PBS or whatever, and playing a pedal steel with a, you know, like the mouth, the vocoder, pedal steel thing. And I don't think it was any of the standard, I don't think it was any of the standard guys that that might have been, you know, everybody knows the one always. But anyway, I remember that as a kid and like being fascinated by that sound, but I don't know who it was. And to this day, I have wondered if I'm remembering it incorrectly or not at all. Right. You know, so anyway, but that's Bob really Seger's one I can confirm that I remember.
Well, I'm going to, don't normally do this, but we're going to skip ahead real quick. And so this was also your answer for another question of song you used to love, but not so much anymore. Was that your realization as you were prepping for this? Like, oh God.
I was listening to it and I was like, I don't know what I saw. I don't know what 2 year old me saw in this. I mean, jam.
You were two, you know?
Yeah. You know, but I really do think that there's something pretty pure and like honest about like really young, when you're really young and you're attracted to music and you have no sense of what's cool and what's not cool or what's aesthetically correct or incorrect. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I've been like kind of as loud and proud as one can be about being a Dave Matthews Band fan, is because the Dave Matthews Band, similar to me, there's a band I heard when I was much younger before I really understood what is what, you know what I mean, the unspoken rules of hip record collecting or anything like that. And I love them for apparently some sort of very pure reason, you know. And so I've always tried to kind of hang on to that, but revisiting Bob Seger's Tightrope, I did not find myself digging it so much this time.
No, I totally I mean, I did a 100 episode podcast about Rancid for fuck's sake. So I mean, like,
I mean,
I'll tell you though, a good way to kill something that you love is do a 100 episode podcast about it. Cause if I never listen to Rancid again, I think I'll be okay.
Well, but, we'll see if I can do, maybe I'll have to consider a Dave Matthews pod, you know, I get Grayson,
Grayson Curran would be your
Riley Walker, you know, the usual suspects.
I love it. Okay. Well, what is a song that either makes you cry, or if it doesn't actually make you cry, at least makes you feel that way, whatever that way, however you want to define it?
Yeah, this is great. I mean, there's a lot of songs that make me cry. I think I'm kind of an easy, crier, I think. Yeah. More so, it depends, you know, it depends on how, how regulated I am, how well, you know, but I do find that, you know, music is a pretty, pretty quickly trips emotional, wires for me. And so I picked the song Cherry Colored Funk by the Cocteau Twins. And I picked it for kind of a specific reason. It's because you don't really know what the lyrics are And that's the thing with Cocteau Twins is sometimes you can kind of make out the words, but they just feel so amorphous. And to me, you know, the fact that semi-gibberish glossolalia, if you want to call it that, this sort of like wordless singing, the fact that it can trigger such strong emotions. There's a part in this song where, as Liz Fraser just like, she just, it's when she first kind of like lets loose with like her big voice in it. It just hits me, and I just find myself like overwhelmingly moved by it.
Yeah.
And it's, and to me, there's lots of songs where the lyrics are so good that they cause me to tear up, or where it's so beautiful that it causes me to tear up, or it's just, you know, gorgeously rendered or tragic sounding. There's lots of songs like that, but to me, I picked this one because it's most interesting to me that something I don't understand can move me to cry. And that is actually to me such a huge, exciting thing about music, and it's tapped into that mystery, right? You know, and space for feelings that, like, because a lot of times when I'm crying, it's like a little bit of nostalgia, a little bit of longing, a little bit of happiness. You know, it's like, it's a complicated thing. And so for music to be able to sort of make space for all that emotional expression, without even making sense on a literal level, to me is really cool and interesting.
Yeah. I know the part of the song you're talking about. I mean, I could say this about Cocteau Twins in general and Liz Fraser specifically, but this song is such a good example. There's just this sense of awe of this thing. It, like, you hear it and it's just, because it feels so like her voice and the, it just feels so like otherworldly and like bigger than itself, if that makes any sense. But
absolutely.
And it's very moving.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. She's one of my favorite vocalists for sure. And it's just the whole band rips on it. Yeah. And it's just that, I mean, that record, Heaven or Las Vegas, like, I was in a band and the lead singer and songwriter and guitarist in that band put that record on for me. He played me that and Talk Talk Spirit of Eden on the same day. So heavy afternoon. Yeah. Heavy afternoon. Good shit.
Yeah. Memorable afternoon, huh?
big time. Yeah. In his minivan. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, what's the song that'll put you in a better mood?
Song that'll put me in a better mood. Well, for this one, you know, I just had to go with Little Birdie by Vince Guaraldi. Most Peanuts music will put me in a better mood. Most Vince Guaraldi will put me in a better mood. It feels weird to call Vince Guaraldi underrated when he's certainly one of the most like popular and best-selling jazz artists in the world, you know, and if somebody owns one jazz album, there's a good chance it's a Charlie Brown Christmas, you know,
right?
If they only own one. Yep. And yet I do think he is underrated. I don't think people give credit for how cool his stuff is. And you could go deeper with them, you know, stuff like the records he's made with Bola Sette, the guitarist. You know, you get some awesome Latin stuff. His stuff was starting to get more and more far out and electric funky by the end, which is what Little Birdie has going for it, as well as his vocals, which were often derided, but I just can't get enough, you know.
Oh, I love the vocals. Yeah.
It's perfect. And this is a song where, I mean, a lot of the time it's just sort of shuffling between two chords, which is perhaps my favorite mode that a song can work in. And many of my own songs do the same thing. But but then it's just got that bubbling bass line that never really stops. And to me, it's just, I don't think you can hear this song and stay in a bad mood, because there's just something.
It's, I mean, yeah, like the boat, it's like effervescent to me. It's just like, it's, you know, like when people talk about writing that jumps off the page, this is like his music that just jumps out of the speakers. And
yeah. And it's also easygoing while still being propulsive. And that is a really tricky balance, right? Because a lot of times you're like laid back and that's one thing. But even when Vince is laid back, there's just always this like barreling forward motion that's like really, really energetic. And so to me, it's like the sort of song where you put it on and you roll the window down. We just hit the zone in Phoenix where it's cool enough to roll the window down. And and this song with a open window is an instant mood lifter for sure.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you about him being underrated. Like, I know what you mean. Like, he's it's in a sort of specific way that he, but I don't think if people, I feel like there's just not enough appreciation for just how good he is, like how great, like his sort of craftsmanship with writing songs. Cause those, you know, like you said, yeah, like balancing the two things of like laid back, but like forward progression, that is not easy. And he does, and he makes it sound effortless.
Yeah. And also, I mean, just like to touch on the Peanuts side of it for 1 second, you know, I think children's entertainment, especially in its more modern form, is often so saccharine and so kind of like not what I would say is a true to life. Whereas I think his music for the Peanuts specials brings a sophistication to Charles Schulz's peanut stories in a way that I think like doesn't condescend to its audience and also suspects that young kids can feel sophisticated and suave and understand eloquence and grace. You know, you don't have to assume that kids are too dumb to get that. I think kids more inherently get these things. And so, you know, I remember even as a kid being obsessed with the Charlie Brown Christmas special and my mom sort of being like, this is so maudlin, you know? And I was like, this is perfect. Even as a kid, I understood that twinge of sadness and melancholy. And so anyway, I think all of that gets baked into Vince's music for the Peanuts specials. And I really, I celebrate his whole catalog, but Little Birdie really, it's way up there.
I know. I want to, this afternoon, when I have to go downtown, I'm going to put the windows down and blast this song.
You got it.
All right, Jason, everybody's favorite question. What is objectively the greatest song of all time?
Man, this one I thought was going to be the hardest one for me. And, and I did spend some time pondering it, but I went with What Goes On by the Velvet Underground, because when What Goes On is playing, again, we're talking about a pretty simple chord structure, pretty repetitive, minimalist, but I just think when I hear this song playing, I can't imagine anything being better than that, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, so it's funny. So you're the second quote unquote music writer I've had on. So Mark Masters was on last year, and this was also his pick for the greatest
song. Was it really?
Of all time.
Mark does a podcast for a project I do here called Wastoids, which is a thing that I do with Sam Means from The Format and Hello Merch, you know, his awesome merch company. And Mark does a great podcast with his buddy John Howard about 7 inches called The Spindle. So Mark and I talk all the time. He lives down in Tucson, but I did not realize he had picked this for his pick. And, and so I'm going to take that synchronicity as a sign to shoot him a text after this.
Perfect.
But it is, I don't know. It's just, you know,
it's a perfect song.
I love garage rock, you know, and I love folk music and I love, you know, the avant-garde. This is all of those things, but also, you know, Loaded might be my favorite BU album, to be honest, like, which this is not on, but it does the same thing that my favorite songs on Loaded do, which is sort of like, exist in, again, this sort of energetic current where it's moving, it's barreling forward. But it's also Lou being like relatively sweet, you know, kind of, And I love the darkness that he conjures up too. But with this one, it's just undeniable.
Right. I think that's the perfect word for it. And it's like one of those songs too. It's like, I could just listen to, like, put it on for, and just loop it for hours.
That's an incredible, I'm completely spacing on who he worked with on it, but maybe last year or the year before, Lee Ranaldo put out a cool collection, and there's a cover of this on it, which is not unlike Vince Guaraldi doing it. It's like piano. Oh. It's a piano pounder version of What Goes On, and so maybe those two are even connected in my brain. Maybe that's why I picked them. You know, but they have a similar thing of like, What Goes On, nobody would hear it and say like, oh yeah, what a relaxing song. But the Velvets do have a strangely natural pace that does feel, if not relaxed, you know, calmly confident, you know?
Yeah.
But then you've got the sort of like rub and aggressive element of it that keeps it kind of like from being just a nice jammer. And it's very powerful, very powerful riff. Good riff.
Yeah, good. It's the hell of a song. I mean, that's really all there is to it. Okay, well, we already talked about the song that you just love, but not so much. So we're not going to talk about Tightrope anymore. But God, it's like, I really love that opening synth chord on Tightrope. It's all fucking downhill from
there. Yeah.
Okay, but enough about Tightrope. Sorry, Bob. All right, what is a song that people hate? Whoever these people are, I don't know who they are. Any group of people, they hate it. You don't care. You love
it. Yeah. I went with Hand in Glove by the Smiths. And with this one, I will say that I just simply picked my favorite Smith song to sub in for all the Smith songs. Because a lot of people strongly dislike Morrissey and strongly dislike his, you know, he obviously is a divisive figure for his many indefensible statements over the years, his racism, his gross you know, behavior, his snottiness, all of that. But I also just find that when I am listening to the Smiths, people around me will take it upon themselves to let me know that they are not a fan of Morrissey, you know, or that his style is sort of too over the top or too overstated. But to me, despite his annoying nature, you know, the Smiths music, it just demonstrated an elegance and power and melodic brilliance that I can never deny it. And it does sort of like always tap into this sort of maybe eternally teenage part of my, of my brain. And, you know, it's like weird because I came to the Smiths through like Death Cab for Cutie covering This Charming Man. Right. So I kind of worked my way backwards, but it was really getting into the Smiths that for me opened up, the recognition of how much I love that era's, you know, UK jangle indie, you know, be it like Lloyd Cole or Prefab Sprout or, you know, the Blue Nile or Talk Talk or, you know, so it's like the Smiths are like kind of part of that to me, and they almost feel like the quintessential thing. But of course, it's so easy to talk about just Morrissey, but with Hand in Glove, we can also really talk about Johnny Marr, who has a much more, people are much more friendly towards, understandably. Right.
Yeah. The Smiths were always a band that I've, like, everyone, like when I was a teenager, so many of my friends loved the Smiths. And it's like one of those bands that I felt like I should like, and I could just never get into it. And I don't know that it was, maybe it was, I don't know. I don't want to say like the, cause yes, more like his vocal style. So there's like a melodramatic flair to it and stuff, but I'm also like really drawn to those kind of things in other projects.
Sure.
I can't, but I do have, but I do have a lot of time for Johnny Marr. I love like the way he plays, like his guitar, like the tone of it, that, because I love that jangly, like that
yeah.
sound you're describing, you know, like whenever you start talking about like jangly UK, I go straight to like Nikki Sudden and like
yeah.
Slow Maps, like, which is like one of my, you know, Nikki Sudden's one of my favorite songwriters of all time. But, and that's not like Nikki Sudden, Slow Maps doesn't feel like a big jump to the Smiths. Right. And
right.
so I couldn't tell you why one deeply resonates with me and the other, and this doesn't. Is, you know, and that is all before all, you know,
sure.
Morrissey is a total whatever.
Yeah.
Fuck that guy. But like, it's interesting to me that,
yeah, I mean, know, I think I'm a big fan of, I'm a big fan of rockabilly guitar, to be honest, even though I'm not necessarily always a big fan of rockabilly. And yeah. I find that, like, I mean, there's some stuff, of course, I dig, but it's not my go-to, certainly not like a subcultural interest. But I hear in Johnny Marr, like, this incredible synthesis of, like, a lot of rockabilly textures, Duane Eddy, that sort of thing, kind of yeah. like big twangy guitar, but also that jangly thing that feels like more in line with like the Birds, you know, mm-hmm. And then all filtered through that sort of post-punk tonal palette. And to me, that's just like an absolute, you know, it's such a winning combination. And then the rhythm section, who also show up on one of my favorite Sinead O'Connor albums later, similar yeah. where you're like, this rules musically. They truly are a band that's much more than the sum of their parts. And then, but the fact that Morrissey's in the band, he's going to monopolize a lot of attention for sure. But I do yeah. think of it as a band, as a combo, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that all makes, I don't know. I don't know if the ship, I never give up on anything. You know, it's like, they're one of those bands I will probably revisit every few years, and someday it may click, someday it may not. I'm not going to lose sleep over it, but you know.
It's so funny that you mentioned that. That's something, yeah, we'll get there, I'm sure.
Yeah. Okay. Do you consider yourself a romantic?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Yeah. You know, and it's funny because you had among the Patreon questions that one uh-huh. could choose from, you've got sexiest song, but then there's also most romantic song. So I had to question, you know, what's the difference there?
Yeah.
What is the, what's the sort of dividing line, you know? And so for romantic song, I went with Just As Long As We Are In Love by Terry Callier, which is just, it's one of my favorites, And it's really song. If we go back to the Bob Seger song, if we go back to Tightrope, which is Tightrope is the through line, what I can hear in both of those choices is like an attraction to very dramatic sound. Mm-hmm. And Just As Long As We Are In Love is pretty like bombastic at one point. There's this part where the horns come in and yep. he kind of raises his voice into this really operatic kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just think there's nothing more romantic than the premise of this song, which is sort of like, no matter what, it's you and I against it all, you know? Mm-hmm. I think he says like, if we face heaven or hell or something even worse, you know, I'm with yeah. you all the way. And to me, there's like that declaration of that, like that pledge of like, I'm here for you mm-hmm. and I'm not going anywhere. And then there's just beautiful balance between those more mountain peak, like bursts of intensity in the song. And then the actual chorus, which settles into just this most like, placid, beautiful, mm-hmm. like just tender little thing. And then right back into the sort of the fray, you know, and it's kind of like a reminder that, you know, my wife, Becky, and I put this on a CD that we gave people at our wedding, with other songs too. But to me, it just really felt like it was one of those songs where it's like, you know, it's nice to hear a song. It's nice to hear something that sort of acknowledges the challenges of keeping something together, but also, mm-hmm. But also celebrates the commitment side of things,
yeah.
you know? And if, yeah. and if I had to answer the, sexiest song, I would maybe say You're Gonna Miss Your Candyman by Terry Kellyer, which is one of the sexiest songs of all time too. So maybe he can probably cover us on both of those.
Right, but yeah. I mean, I mean, his voice is so damn smooth that he could, he's got us covered.
absolutely incredible. And, you know, I had the great, great fortune of getting to write a set of liner notes for Kraft Recordings, their edition of the new folk sound of Terry Kallier, an earlier, earlier folkier thing. That was a few years ago. And really spending time with that record, spending time with his discography, just cemented just what an incredible vocalist he is. But beyond that, what an incredible songwriter, what an incredible guitarist. And as somebody who's drawn to folk music, but also soul music and also R&B, he really does sort of exist in this this zone alongside like very few people, you know, Van Morrison, you know, people who kind of like thread that needle. But Terry's just so good.
That's awesome. I love that pick. All right, well, what's a song that changed your perspective on an artist, either for better or for worse?
Yeah, with this one, I went to really incredible live take from, I think the record's called Emergency Ward, but it's by Nina Simone. And this is her doing My Sweet Lord, George Harrison's song, and the standard Today is a Killer. And it's sort of this thing where she goes from My Sweet Lord into Today is a Killer into My Sweet Lord again. I think I knew who Nina Simone was, and I think I understood Nina Simone's powerful voice and her grace and how, you know, commanding she is as a figure. But I think it was hearing this for the first time. I had taken the record home from my job at a record store, and I came home and put it on, and I think this is like the final song on one of the sides or whatever. But it was sort of this thing where I was sitting there listening to it, and then as this song got going, my listening posture changed from a much more ambient sense to like really paying attention. Like I kind of had no choice, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? You know, she sings with a rage and furiosity that you certainly don't associate with the song My Sweet Lord.
I know, but, yes.
But, you know, to bring the sort of beatific, you know, devotional quality of the Harrison song, and then to sort of meld that with the almost accusational, like, you know, Today is a Killer is essentially saying, you know, like, God is a killer, like God kills us, God destroys, like the universe, whatever you want to call it, you know, it has the power to create and it has the power to undo. And to me, you know, if you're going to sing about the topic of God, you know, you're going to have to bring all of that to bear, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can't just have the sweet, serene, everything's good, rosy thing. You have to also talk about, you know, how could a loving God allow for so much injustice, destruction, death, pain? And Nina does, and it just, it really made me realize that, like, it's not just, I think maybe my perception of her was as a powerful interpreter of song and like a protest singer. But with this, I realized that the protest element could go much wider and much more expansive than, staid political tracks, talking points, you know, it's like sort of like a protest song to the universe and, you know, but then also beautiful and also incredible. And I love that George Harrison song and I love George Harrison. And so, you know, it's just, to me, I just couldn't picture any other person doing it this way after hearing this song. And it just, it completely altered my view of how remarkable Nina Simone actually is as an artist.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. I felt like it expanded my understanding of her, and just like you, it was just this. It's like, oh, it's like so much bigger than I thought.
It's scary. It's like scary. what yeah. she does, you know?
Yeah.
And that to me is like, that's awesome. You know, they're definitely tied in my head because Warren Ellis wrote that great book, Nina Simone's Chewing Gum. But when I saw the Bad Seeds at Coachella of all places in 2013, you know, they were doing Push the Sky Away and this like, you know, dirt cloud of, you know, just like a wave of dirt blew over the crowd, you know, from the desert. And there's these red lights on stage. And it was both beautiful and scary. And I thought to myself, yeah. this is what, you know, quote unquote, the holy is. The experience of the holy yeah. is both terrifying and sublime. And to me, this is like a song that sort of illustrates
yeah.
that tension. Yeah. Between those yeah. poles, you know, because they both exist. They both exist yeah. in the experience.
And again, like that is a, there are a few people that could pull that off. Like, I mean, nobody, so I don't few. Think, you know, I mean, no one's pulling this off. This is like singular performance for only Nina Simone could do, but just, yeah. yeah, that feeling is some, yeah. So, but yeah, I love this pick. Cause I had a similar experience when I heard it. And it was, I was like, I thought I had a pretty good understanding of Nina Simone. It was like, oh, you didn't.
So. It's cool to have your view expanded. You know, that's like the, yeah. that's, we, you know, we, before we got taping, I think we talked about that, you know, the fear of burnout. And yeah. when I start to feel like my view can't be expanded, that's when I know, you know, that that's set in, you know, because mm-hmm. it's the most reliable thing music can do for me is
for sure.
make me realize something deeper. So, yeah.
Yeah. Are you a big lyrics guy? Do you pay
attention to lyrics? You know, it's funny because we talked about the Cocteau Twins earlier and how, mm-hmm. you know, you can be moved without knowing the lyrics. And that's true. I listen yeah. to a lot of instrumental music. I listen to a lot of, you know, music in languages that I don't understand or speak. Mm-hmm. But I am a big lyrics guy. And I am very, very, I am very attuned to lyrics. And find myself focusing in on them, you know, certainly when I'm writing about yeah. something, you know, for sure.
Can bad lyrics ruin an otherwise good song for you?
No, not for me, honestly. I think great lyrics can elevate a song into sure. the pantheon. But the truth is, the lyric would have to be so egregious to ruin. You know, it's funny because like, you know, like little things like rhyming the same word, you know, rhyming a word with the same word. there are a few instances of that on the record I made with Zach, you know, where I did that, you know, and yeah. like I mentioned how sort of we were just kind of going for it.
Sure.
And I had to look at some of those lyrics and be like, I'm just like stating the same word over again. And it's kind of like, I don't know. I think that can be fine. I think that could be fun. It doesn't yeah. have to mean like on one hand, you fear that that's like a bad lyric, but on another hand, I don't worry about it. So generally, I mean, a lyric, like I said, would have to be so bad.
Sure.
Take me out of the song, but I can forgive a lot. But that yeah. said, when the song's lyrics match its, you know, its melodic power, that's
yeah,
that's incredible. You know, you're at the top of the
speaking
mountain.
Of which, so what are your favorite lyrics? Well, this is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, I went with my dear songwriting hero, one of them, Judy Sill, and her song Loping Along Through the Cosmos, because I don't know, sometime over the last year I just realized that this was the song that I needed. These were the words I needed to hear and to yeah. And to like really the whole song, really, you know. The first lyric is loping along through the cosmos and sideways I slide through the square. Okay, I don't know what slide through the square means, but it sounds pretty correct, right? Yeah. And then yeah. she says, I'm hoping so hard for a kiss from God. I miss the sweet love of the air. And to me, everything she's doing in this song, she lays out these different things. You know, I was doing this and it prevented me from recognizing this. She says, I was looking so hard for a place to land, I almost forgot how to fly, you know? And to me, being content in what is happening is what you're after. And and I feel like this song is about that, but it's really the chorus that, you know, for me, acted almost like a healing balm. She says, so keep on moving or stay by my side. Either way, I'll tell you a secret I've never revealed. However we are is okay. To me, that just says it all right there. Whatever you need to, you just have to, it's a freedom. It's a grace extended to another person. It's a grace extended to Judy Sill herself, is extending it to herself. She's somebody who, you watch that documentary and she really beat herself up in her diaries. She was really, really terrifically self-critical and often cruel to herself. I identify and deeply, you know, understand that. So in this song, you get the sense she was writing it because it's what she needed to hear. And she taps into this universal zone that allows all of us to maybe extend that kindness to ourselves. It's also just really beautiful, you know? And I mean, I think it's like up there with like Dylan, Leonard Cohen, kind of, you know, the poetic power of it and the biblical, almost you know, revelatory mystic quality. It's
very,
so much
prayer like to me, like very it really captures that. I think that's a good way of putting it. It's like, it's the song that all of us need to hear at some point.
It's so funny. It's so funny because one of my other choices for this was Don't Worry Baby by the Beach Boys, which is essentially kind of the same thing, right? It's saying like, don't worry. So I guess that's the top line for me, right? Is like, I need to be told to quit stressing out. I need permission to let my anxiety go, you know, things like that.
Be a little less hard on yourself, Jason.
If at all possible. Yeah.
I'm 45 years old and been working on it all my life. All right, we're going to, what is a song or the song that you have or can listen to the most?
I picked this year's answer, or part last year, part this year. The song Soiree by Bill Evans. And I got into a zone where I just listened to this song for like on a loop for a really, really long time. It's very placid, very, very beautiful. There are many selections in the Bill Evans catalog that qualify as both of those things. But there's a combination of his acoustic piano and very gentle electric piano in this that's kind of rare in his, he doesn't have a lot of like electric piano in the mix.
This is the first time he ever used a Fender Rhodes on this song. Yeah.
And it's incredible because to me, that's one of the most perfect sounds period is a Fender Rhodes.
Yep.
And so to hear him play it like this and in this like just beautiful life little song that feels sad, but also pretty and melancholy, but sort of peaceful. To me, it's like a world I could get lost in. And so I just, when I find a song like that, particularly instrumental stuff or jazz stuff, I will just put that repeat. Infinite repeat on and let it go for a few hours. And I never seem to exhaust the well, you know, with it. That's how I felt.
Totally. I feel that way about a lot of Bill Evans stuff, I feel, but this one is particularly notable. I really like, I think Sam Brown plays guitar in it. I think I really like the guitar.
Yeah. There's a part in it that where the guitar is, mournfully out of tune for one or like maybe it's a clam even where he just hits a weird and he kind of bends it into the correct pitch. It just floors me, kills me, fills me with like all good feelings. I love it so much, you know. Same. In this perfect song, this sort of moment of imperfection that only underscores the beauty that much more. And that's I love it. Yeah. So yeah, beautiful. No, and his guitar is incredible on it.
It's such a it's a great song. And like, how it covers all these different threads and emotions in it. But it's all like it's like the power of gentleness, because it's so gentle and like powerful at the same time. And it's like, it's there's a reason that Bill Evans is one of the all-timers.
It's true. It's true. He's great.
Yeah. What's the song you most recently fell in love with?
Well, since filling out this application, I will say it's I'll go with what I said. I'll talk about what I sent, but I want to say that a lot of the songs on the new Tim Heidecker record would qualify. I ended up spending a lot of time with it after I sent this in, and so there's a handful of songs from that record that I would actually throw into this question now if I were being, chronologically honest. Right. But at the time, I said Saucer Crash by Tom Verlaine, which is from his 1982 album Medium Cool, another instrumental. Tom Verlaine of television doing kind of noir soundscapes, and this song Saucer Crash has this sci-fi quality to it. I'm obsessed with UFOs and aliens and things like that, as is
Star Trek.
So it's all in the mix. Yeah. But he also does this. I DJ'd this song out on Sunday night at one of my favorite bars. And I did this to sort of set the mood. Atoth Lee was playing incredible along with Dirt Roads, a really cool native country band. But I dropped this one, and Verlaine does this like pick scrape in the song a number of times where he's like, it's like hyper fast vibrato pick scrape sound. And I just looked out at the room and saw people kind of go, kind of take notice at this bizarre, creepy little thing. And I felt like I turned the bar and grill into Twin Peaks Roadhouse for a second. Amazing. And I felt really good about it. And so I'm a huge television fan, Tom Verlaine and Richard Lloyd, one of my all time favorite combinations of guitarists. But, but this someone, they Real Gone just reissued a handful of Tom Verlaine records, late era Verlaine stuff. And it's all so good. I've got a piece that I'm working on for Aquarium Drunkard that I'll be sharing soon. But yeah, so Saucer Crash by Tom Verlaine with the side of Tim Heidecker.
There we go. Yeah, this song is, the guitar tone on that he has, like on that lead part, is so gnarly and great. I love it so much. Oh man,
it's surprisingly clean. It's kind of like Richard Thompson, where you hear it and you're like, oh, he's not actually distorting very much, but he gets a growl that comes more from the maybe the pressure on the strings, right. Really cool.
Yeah. All right, two questions left, two big questions. What is the song that means the most to you?
I went with To Make You Feel My Love by Bob Dylan, because a few years ago, my wife Becky and I were in Hanalei in Hawaii on the island of Kauai, and we were at this great little bar restaurant, and there was a live band, and as we were leaving to walk back to our Airbnb, I heard this song. And the band was playing it, and it was just a perfect moment. Yeah. It was a perfect moment of like just lingering outside with this incredible moon over us and this beautiful landscape and these lyrics. And, the band wasn't even like, they weren't like the most, they weren't the best band I ever heard or anything, but them singing this song the way they were, with the feeling they were, just was enough. And so it just really got lodged into my head. And there's a million Bob Dylan songs that could qualify for me. I'm a big Dylan fan. But this one, again, perhaps uncharacteristically sweet from Dylan. Yeah. And I do like uncharacteristically sweet.
I do too. Well, if you're a big Dylan guy, you got to come out to Tulsa. We got the Bob Dylan Center.
I know, it seems so cool. I talked with the Jokerman guys about that, and maybe trying to figure out some way to do something out there someday. So maybe we'll see what we can do.
If it ever does, if you need an intro or anything, let me know. I can.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
I can hook it up. We did some stuff with them two summers ago. That I can't talk about yet, but some pretty exciting stuff that is in the works.
I can't wait to hear.
That they were part of. So, all right, last question. What's your favorite song? At least in this moment in time. Maybe it changes, but maybe this is it always.
I went with Tale in Hard Time by Fairport Convention because it's a song where the first time I heard it, you know, this incredible intro, these like, you know, like kind of circling guitars, and then the harmonies come in and you've got all the band singing, and it just sounded like the clouds parting. And it was like one of those things. I think I picked this song as a favorite because I had liked Fairport Convention, but I got a record. And when it got to this song, it was when I realized that I didn't just like Fairport Convention. This meant like a lot to me. This was bigger than just, oh, I like this band. And that song to me just is a really undeniable one. And the syncopation of the snare hits is like unbelievable to me. So much of that classic Brit folk stuff is like so fucking funky that people do not like give it credit.
I totally agree.
And they're doing this sort of trad folk thing, but somehow they're making it sound so groovy. And and in this one, it's almost power poppy. And it's just like, anyway, that song to me, I figured why, you know, that, there are a million possible answers to this question. But this one, at least, let's say, you know, a few times out of 10 would be my answer, right? So,
this song, like, that, you know, you always hear people, the describing of that, like, oh, like clouds parting song. That's this song. That is exactly how the song makes you feel.
So
and
good.
I got a lot of time and a lot of love for Richard Thompson.
Oh yeah, and his tone and his solo on this, just mind blowing. So
yeah,
he's amazing. An all time hero.
Absolutely. Well, this was a damn fun time.
Damn fun.
Thank you for doing it. Two Against Nurture. God, that's a great title. That's a great title. Hats off to you guys. It's out. Well, by the time this comes out, it'll be out. So
it will be. Yeah.
Go check it out.
I think I told you that it was coming out today, but I was wrong. It's coming out next Tuesday. So,
okay.
But it'll all be good. So,
yeah, this will be out in like November. So, hey,
it'll be out.
It'll be all news by then.
It'll be all news. No one will. Yeah. We'll have moved on. Brad, thanks so much for the opportunity. It's really an absolute pleasure. I appreciate it so much.
Well, thank you so much for doing it. Once again, thank you to Jason Woodbury. These episodes are so much fun. God, it's just like hanging out, chilling with a friend. You know, can't beat that. Two Against Nurture is out now on Fort Lowell Records. It's his EP, three-song EP with Dad Weed, and more coming soon in that realm. He's always doing stuff over at Aquarium Drunkard, Transmissions Podcast, all that stuff. Tons of links in the show notes. You should be checking those all out, following those. And of course, the link to his playlist for his picks. As ever, if you enjoy the show, enjoy this episode, enjoy the show in general, please leave a rating or review both. I don't know if you can do one or the other. Maybe you got to do both. I honestly have no idea. That's probably not good. I don't know how that works. Maybe I'm not going to review my own show. That would be weird. But yeah, please leave a rating and review. Wherever you listen to podcasts, helps with all that algorithmic bullshit. And you can, of course, find the Songs of Our Lives Patreon, Patreon.com/FoxyDigitalis if you're really enjoying the show. $3 a month, you get extended episodes, the unedited ones, if you will. I mean, they're edited, but there's a whole other section. You get a Merle, you get other stuff. It's a good time over there. And hey, it really supports the cause. So thank you to everybody who is doing that. And otherwise, that's about it for me. So keep on listening to whatever the hell you want.